From Mexico's presidential election to Canadian tariffs, international trade in Texas could see some big changes. Developments over the weekend come as trade tension grows between the U.S. and our allies. I'm Craig Cohen. Next on Houston Matters, we consider what it all means for the Lone Star State's future in the global economy. Also this hour, why an independent crime lab established to replace one shuttered due to evidence backlog scandals has a backlog of its own. We learn what's being done about it. Then examples from U.S. history of things we think we know but maybe don't have quite right. Like, should we really celebrate our independence on Wednesday? Cases could be made for dates other than July 4th. We'll ask area historian Nancy Beck Young. Plus, the Rockets lock up Chris Paul but lose Trevor Ariza and miss out on LeBron James. We discuss the repercussions of yesterday's NBA free agency frenzy with Jeff Balke. These and other Houston matters follow this hour's news. This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. The Lone Star State's role in the global economy could see some changes in the wake of developments over the weekend. That includes Mexico's presidential election and retaliatory tariffs from Canada. Ed Herz is an economics lecturer and energy fellow at the University of Houston. He joins us now. Ed, welcome back to Houston Matters.
Thank you, Craig.
Let's start with Mexico's presidential election. Leftist Andrés Manuel López Obrador, a.k.a. AMLO, he won the election. What do you think could be the immediate impact of his election for the state of Texas?
Well, it'd be very interesting. It's a tremendous change in going away from the to Obrador. He's leftist, he's populist, he's nationalist. He was elected certainly more on the internal problems that Mexico has than the external problems relating to trade and trade with Texas, trade with the United States. But that's going to be part of what he needs to have to build the internal Mexican economy, to rebuild it, to move away from the corruption problems that they've had for the last two decades.
I want to dive more into trade in a few minutes, but generally speaking, how would you characterize the current economic relationship between Mexico and the state of Texas?
It's very, very strong. The U.S. Exported about $250 billion of goods to Mexico last year. We imported more than $320 billion, running a net deficit. But of course, we buy an awful lot of agricultural products. We buy a lot of goods from Mexico. That supports a lot of jobs in Mexico. Every time the Mexican economy does well and is growing, that puts actually less strain on the immigration issues that we have with Mexican workers trying to come into the United States to find jobs. It's a very symbiotic relationship. It's much better than it was pre-NAFTA, due to the jobs, due to the flow of goods, due to the easier flows of capital back and forth across the border.
So agriculture, manufacturing, those are a couple of big industries that we see that occurring. Are there others here in Greater Houston?
Yes, and for Houston, we're seeing an awful lot with energy. We're exporting natural gas to Mexico via pipelines. We've been exporting refined products to Mexico, gasoline, diesel. We bring in Mexican crude, refine it, send it back. We provide that value add. We're exporting electricity across the border too, in with some of our power stations that are located along the southern border.
When it comes to trade policy, Mexico's president-elect has talked about it during his campaign. He's talked about the global economy during his campaign, but not always consistently, at least according to Alfonso López de la Osa Escribano with the University of Houston Law Center.
He was a bit contradictory at the beginning of his campaign, but he was more reassuring at the end. And for sure, yesterday at his speech, after winning the election. At the beginning, he really showed a more nationalistic approach in terms of trade. And afterwards, he was evolving to a more understanding and, I would say, cooperative messages he was sending. We could see at the end that he was more focused on what he called, and he mentioned again in his speech yesterday, wanting to have a friendly relationship with Mexico, cooperating in terms of development and of mutual respect. So this can give us, like I would say, hope that he will reinforce the relationship with the United States from Mexico in the aspects that really are going to be benefiting both countries.
That was Alfonso de la Osa Escribano with the University of Houston Law Center. We're talking with University of Houston economics lecturer and energy fellow Ed Herz. Ed, how do you think the outcome of Mexico's presidential election could impact our trade relationship with Mexico on a policy standpoint?
On a policy standpoint, I think the Mexican government is going to be very open to reducing trade barriers and increasing the flows of capital. This is what they need to re-stimulate their oil economy. This is what they need to re-stimulate and keep moving their agricultural economy. A $70 billion trade deficit for the U.S. is a $70 billion trade surplus for Mexico. If we get bogged down in a trade war with increasing tariffs, things that reduce the exports and reduce the imports back and forth, this is going to lead to unemployment on both sides of the border. This is going to lead to economic recession on both sides of the border because there will just simply be less sales. There'll be less revenues. There'll be less tax revenues. There'll be less employment.
Is this the perspective of the Trump administration?
It's hard to say. The Trump administration has essentially abrogated the NAFTA agreement with the application of tariffs to Mexican goods with the application of tariffs to Canadian goods. If this stands, then it's going to be, I think, quite negative for all three economies.
Now, President Trump did say he was going to wait until after the midterm elections to contemplate any renegotiation of NAFTA. I know it's sort of crystal ball gazing here, but what's your sense of where this may be going?
Well, I think we have to look at the actions, and the actions are that he's abrogated the NAFTA treaty with this imposition of tariffs on both sides, to the north in Canada and to the south of Mexico. At the moment, he's torn up NAFTA.
What does that mean for Texas jobs specifically?
Texas exports about $100 billion a year, and a lot of that goes to Mexico. I think the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, the El Paso branch, pointed out that 18,000 workers cross the border every day to work in U.S. jobs and then return home to Mexico. There's an awful lot that's in the flow of activity. Revenues beget wages, beget payments, and tax revenues. And if we begin to interrupt this flow, even marginally, this is going to come down on a bunch of workers. The irony is, this is going to really impact President Trump's electoral base more than it's going to impact the capital base.
Last month, Mexico imposed trade tariffs on the U.S. in retaliation of the import duties by President Trump. Does Sunday's election change that situation at all?
Well, when the new president takes office, he has an opportunity to reduce those, but if the Trump tariffs are maintained, it's still going to be a negative for the Mexican economy. It's difficult to walk into a negotiation just simply accepting the tariffs that your trade partner has imposed unilaterally without having some sort of response. The Mexican government doesn't have any real leverage if they just simply allow those tariffs to stay in place. They will have to look for other trade partners, perhaps the Chinese. And Europe will pick up the slack that is created by the U.S. tariffs.
Let's talk a little bit about Canada, which announced yesterday it's imposing retaliatory tariffs on nearly $13 billion worth of U.S. goods. Which goods and which industries does this affect most directly here in Houston?
Well, in Houston, it's going to be mainly with energy. Most of our trade relating with Canada is energy, crude oil, natural gas, equipment, and capital flows, investors. Can we get investment up to Canada? Can they get investment down to the United States and back and forth? The agricultural products, it's a small amount. It's, $13 billion across the entire economy is not that large of a number. I would expect that to have more of an impact in the border states with Canada, Michigan, for example, automakers, Wisconsin, New York.
Meanwhile, the European Union's warning it could impose nearly $300 billion in retaliatory tariffs. What's your take on that?
Well, that's another salvo in the tit-for-tat trade war that President Trump appears to have set off here. This will not be beneficial. President Trump has talked about imposing tariffs on European automobiles. So, you know, Volkswagen, BMW, Audi, those that aren't made in the United States. We've seen the impact. I guess the poster child is going to be Harley Davidson for this. Harley has decided that they will just absorb the 25% tariff increase that they would have to pay going into Europe. But as a consequence, they're going to go ahead and move jobs out of the United States into Europe, into their European manufacturing operations, and build the bikes over there. We saw this decades ago. The reason we have a Toyota truck manufacturing plant in Texas is because the United States has a 25% tariff on light trucks that are imported into the U.S. And so that's Toyota decided it would be cheaper just to build a plant in Texas.
Ed Herz is an economics lecturer and energy fellow at the University of Houston. Ed, thanks very much.
Thank you, Craig.
Just ahead, Houston's independent crime lab pledges to clear another backlog. Sound familiar? We'll tell you why as Houston Matters continues. This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. The city of Houston's independent crime lab, the Houston Forensic Science Center, is spending $2 million to clear a backlog of hundreds of rape kits and other DNA evidence. If that sounds at all familiar, it's because we've sort of been here before. At least the old Houston crime lab was here before it was shuttered due to evidence backlog scandals. To discuss that history and what it has to do with today's crime lab, we're joined now by Dr. Peter Stout, president and CEO of the Houston Forensic Science Center. Dr. Stout, welcome back to Houston Matters.
Great, thanks. I appreciate being here.
And as we chat, we welcome you to our conversation as well at 713-440-8870 or talk at HoustonMatters.org. First, remind us about the old crime lab. What sorts of issues and scandals led to it being closed down?
I usually find myself pointing out to people the 2003 headline in the New York Times of the worst crime lab in the country. That's what Houston was. I know people internationally that know what Houston was. It is internationally renowned for backlog problems and poor training and lack of resources and all of these things that went into making what Houston was. So now what we've been trying to do in the last few years is move from that to something that people, again, have some trust in.
Before we get to what you're doing now, how much of a backlog did the old crime lab have when the time came that it was clear it needed to be shut down and this whole thing needed to be rethought?
So people like to concentrate on the DNA backlog. So at that point, there were close to 10,000 backlog sexual assault kits, but there also at that time was about 42,000 backlog controlled substances or drug cases. There were backlogs in firearms. There were backlogs in toxicology. There were backlogs basically in everything.
And how was all of that ultimately addressed?
So a lot of that was addressed in creating Houston Forensic Science Center. There was a lot of work that went into getting laboratory aspects accredited. We've got one more section that needs to be accredited, and that's the crime scene unit, which you've probably heard some about crime scene in the last couple of years. But we've worked through, in partnership with the DA's office and HPD, how we cleared out the controlled substances backlogs and in firearms and in toxicology. And we've been rebuilding sections all along as we've been looking to fix poor procedures of the past and get backlogs cleared out.
The Houston Forensic Science Center opened in 2014. What, in terms of its organization, its approach, makes it different from the old crime lab?
Well, it's different from the old crime lab, and it's also different from a lot of things around the country. It is a local government corporation, which is a quirk in Texas law that allows for a semi-corporate formation to do work for a government. I actually have a 9-member citizen board of directors. They're appointed by the mayor. They're approved by city council. Once they're on that board, there are a lot of protections against their being removed. They really have to basically commit a felony in order to be removed from the board. And that was by design to create a place where the forensic science could be occurring separate from law enforcement, separate from prosecution, and with some degree of insulation from the politics of the city. So that board is who actually approves our budget that then becomes part of the city's budget. And that board is my boss. Those are the ones that can fire me if stuff's not going right.
Let's talk about that stuff. How long does it take to test DNA evidence?
It's really variable. It's something that people have to understand about DNA is it's a very complex process, and oftentimes we're talking many multiple items of evidence within those cases. So, for instance, we've got one capital murder case that's been being worked on for almost 8 years, hundreds of items, thousands of tests in just that one case. That one's an extreme. More is more typical as we have between 7 and 11 items of evidence within any given case, and probably 30 to 40 tests that are performed on that. So typically we can get work done. If we started on only one case and we're working only one case, we can get stuff done within about 30 days. We batch things together, and complexities in the testing are what start to add to the whole length of what it takes to do a case.
Walk us through the different steps when it comes mm-hmm. to each of these cases. What are they? How do you go about that kind of testing?
You can kind of think of it in three steps. The first step is what we refer to as screening, or used to be called serology. It is looking at the items of evidence, determining if there are biological stains there, if there's things that may contain DNA. Are there items that are appropriate to test? That's probably about the easiest step.
So this is basically you get a bagged piece of evidence and you stare at it. You look at it under a microscope. You're looking for potential things, elements that you can test.
That we can test, right. Okay. So it would be determining if there actually is a semen stain there, or if there's blood, or if there are things that we would expect there to be biological evidence there.
Okay.
Once that's done, they do what's called portioning. So we take a portion of that evidence. We work really hard to preserve evidence for future testing or testing by defense or anybody else. That portion then goes on now for the chemistry part of what everybody thinks of as stuff that happens in the lab. They're going to extract the DNA from that. They're going to quantify the amount of DNA that's there. And we do a process of what we call stop at quant. If there's not enough DNA that we don't expect we're ever going to get a sufficient profile for comparison, we stop there. But we determine how much DNA is there. If we've got enough DNA, then we go on for amplifying that DNA. That's where we make millions of copies of the DNA that's there so that we can then look at it. And that's the point at which we do the sequencing, which is determining the pieces that are there. So that's basically the second part that happens in the lab. And actually, that happens fairly quickly for us. The third part is where the time really goes into it, and that's looking at all of those data, and that's the people that are having to go through and calculate the statistics and determine the profile, and can the profile be compared against the national database. If we do have a hit from the database, do those two profiles compare? Doing all of that statistical analysis, that's really what takes the time. And in our process, and this happens in a lot of laboratories, it's relatively easy to get people trained for the first two components of that. Mm-hmm. It's much more difficult to get people trained for the third component. And what happens in laboratories is you get people in, start training them typically at the front of the process, because the people that are doing the data analysis need to understand the whole process. And life takes over. Things like hurricanes and freezes. And a year or so ago, we had to change our basic chemistries because of requirements from the FBI. All of those things then distract and keep people from finishing out all of that training. So what we've got is we've got quite a few people in the first couple of steps, and we don't have enough people in that last step. So really that's what we're trying to do in this, is create enough time and space for this group to complete the cross-training of all the individuals. They're all trained in their individual steps, but we need to get them all cross-trained so now we can shift people between those steps and address where we end up with a bottleneck.
So how do you do that? How do you get them cross-trained while also keep up with the number of cases you have to clear?
Well, the good news in biology is we actually can use what are called outsourced labs. There are some commercial laboratories. There's not very many of them. There's only three or four of them in the country. We can use outsourced labs to move some of the work to those laboratories. So what we will do is work that's coming in, we'll send out to an outsourced lab. They'll do the chemistry parts. And that creates enough time for our group to then spend the next 10 months on training to cross-train these people. I want to be really clear. The people are trained in their steps. It's getting people cross-trained between the steps so that they can do all of those steps.
How many cases do you have? How much of a backlog do you have right now?
So right now we've got, I think, about 240 sexual assault kits. And something to keep in mind about backlog is all across the country, everybody measures backlog differently.
How do you measure it?
We measure it as the point at which an agency requests the test to the point at which we send out a final report. So we try to reflect the time that really is what the victims are waiting for, or the defendants, or the investigators, or the DAs, or what they're really waiting for of the laboratory.
And how long is that taking right now?
Right now, total average in biology is about 130 days. We've got about 200 sexual assault kits that are over 30 days, and only about 80 of those that are over 90 days. So we could talk about how other laboratories measure backlogs. Some use 60 days, some use 90 days. If I use 90 days, we'd only have 80 kits backlogged. If I use 60, we'd have about 150 that are backlogged. And you'll also see around the country that where laboratories have those two endpoints, sometimes it's when they receive the evidence, sometimes it's when they open the evidence. And so the time that they're reflecting of their process is much shorter. If I did that of reflecting when we have opened the evidence to when we send out a draft report, which is what some labs do, we wouldn't have any backlog.
Is this one of those scenarios where every lab in the country in one form or another will always be behind on a certain number of cases?
There's always going to be cases that have additional complexities, and you've got to go back for additional testing and things like that. I think it is something that nationwide we need to figure out how to get closer to the time that's necessary. I talk a lot with the staff about it's the right answer at the right time, because a wrong answer on time doesn't do anybody good, but neither does the right answer too late to actually do anything about it. So like in controlled substances, right now we're seeing a spike in a particular drug called carfentanil, which is an extraordinarily toxic opioid. Right now in controlled substances, we finished the work in about 6 to 8 days. So officers, first responders that are in the field know almost real time that we've got these drugs that are out there. If we were like other laboratories that was 6 months to a year, they wouldn't know that these things are out there for 6 months to a year. So backlogs mean different things for different disciplines. And it's important that we shrink those down, because we need those answers to be there for the justice system in a timely fashion.
We reached out to the Harris County District Attorney's Office for comment. According to Kim Ogg's office, quote, "We support any effort to increase efficiency without jeopardizing accuracy. Resolving these cases is paramount, not just to public safety, but to victims' peace and need for closure." Is that part of the math that you do, thinking about the fact that you're dealing with evidence that is in an active prosecution? There's an active investigation. There are people who have been victims of crimes, or family members who are victims of crimes, and they want some resolution to this. And what they hear is, well, we're waiting on evidence, and it could be months.
Yep. It's horrible. We really in Houston are in a really good position that our backlogs are as small as they are compared to a lot of places in the country. But if your sample is in that backlog, it's the world. And yeah, we think about that every day. And backlogs cause the whole system to make really horrible decisions. Do I prioritize a double homicide over a triple rape? Do I prioritize, serial rapists over serial murders? Those are untenable decisions. And as long as there's backlogs, the system is having to make those choices. And those are choices that we shouldn't have to do. Nobody wants those choices to be there. We want to get this evidence done so that victims, so that defendants, so that the justice system can function effectively.
So you are spending a couple $1 million to outsource some of these cases, try and get some of them cleared, while at the same time cross-training your staff so that they can handle a larger volume, particularly in that end stage of this process. At what point will you feel you are completely trained and completely staffed, and this is sort of the maximum efficiency at which the crime lab can operate?
So actually, I think at the end of this, in about 10 months, we'll be there. We think we have the right number of people. They just aren't in the right place. So for instance, that last step, the data analysis step, we've got 6 analysts right now that can do that step. We figure we need 12 to keep up with the typical work that we see coming in. When we're done with this 10-month stretch, we're hoping we will have 30 people that can do those steps. Obviously, we've got other steps to do, but we can then move people around to address where a bottleneck may occur. Obviously, there are limits. If we see a big spike in the number of cases coming in, we'll have to address that. And I think it should give us enough capacity to deal with what we would typically expect to be coming in.
Dr. Peter Stout is president and CEO of the Houston Forensic Science Center. Peter, thanks very much.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Just ahead, things we think we know about American history that maybe we don't have quite right. Stay with us as Houston Matters continues. This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. A case could be made that we should be celebrating America's independence today and not Wednesday. While the original Declaration of Independence is dated July 4, 1776, the legal separation of the original 13 colonies from Great Britain actually took place 2 days earlier, on July 2nd, when the Second Continental Congress actually voted to approve a resolution of independence. This is but one example of the many details about our history that, well, maybe we miss something, or misinterpret it, fudge a little, or outright forget over time. With that in mind, we thought it might be interesting to talk about a number of examples from American history of things we think we know but maybe don't have quite right, or at the very least, are more complicated than we remember. To help us delve into such examples, we are joined by University of Houston historian Nancy Beck Young. Nancy, welcome back to Houston Matters.
Craig, thanks for having me.
And we welcome any examples you'd like to share or questions you have about popular events from U.S. history that you think maybe aren't exactly described in the way they really went down. You can give us a call at 713-440-8870. You can email us at talk@houstonmatters.org. Reach out on Twitter at Houston Matters. Nancy, it's not just that we could make a case for July 2nd, we could also argue for August 2nd, right?
Yes, that is correct. So, very quick history lesson for everyone who's listening. Those that declared independence met on July 1st to discuss the matter and ultimately take a final vote. And the discussions ensued over the course of the 1st. On the 2nd, a vote was taken as to whether or not to declare independence, and the vote was 12 in favor and one against. So a vote in favor of declaring independence from Great Britain was taken on the 2nd of July. The language in the Declaration of Independence had not yet been agreed to. Thomas Jefferson was still writing and rewriting. And it was on July the 4th that the language in the Declaration of Independence was approved. The final draft was approved. So the celebration is on July 4th for that reason. But the Declaration of Independence was not signed until a month later. And that's the reason for your argument for August, not July.
The musical 1776 lied to me.
Exactly.
Some things we think we know about U.S. history are the result of myths created for one reason or another. Case in point, did George Washington chop down a cherry tree and then fess up to it when he was a kid?
No and no.
Where did that story come from?
So that story came from an enterprising Federalist who was also a writer. And while George Washington eschewed political parties, he thought they were tremendously dangerous for the success and health of the United States, his policies nonetheless lined him up with one of the first two political parties, the Federalists. And that party gained strength in the aftermath of Washington's presidency, but they were challenged by the Democratic Republicans, a party associated with Thomas Jefferson. Mason Parson Weems was a Federalist, and he wanted to do everything in his power to advance the cause of federalism, and he also wanted to make money. And he thought that the way to accomplish both of those goals at the same time was to write a biography of George Washington after his death that talked about the virtues of Washington's life, private and public, And he wanted to write this book in such a way that young Americans, children, would be encouraged to follow in Washington's model. So he invented the story of Washington chopping down the cherry tree to sell books and encourage people to become Federalists and live like Washington.
To sell books, sometimes money is a big motivating factor in all of this. Abner Doubleday was a long time credited with inventing the game of baseball. First of all, did he?
No.
Okay. Who was Abner Doubleday and how did he come to be credited for this?
Well, so Abner Doubleday was affiliated with the town of Cooperstown, New York, where the Baseball Hall of Fame is located now. As a result of Abner Doubleday's mythologizing of Doubleday. Excuse me, I said that backwards.
No, it's fine because and this is an important point. He never claimed that he invented baseball. He has nothing to do with any of this.
Yeah,
as it turns
and that's out. That's what I was going back to correct my own.
Right.
Yes. So advocates of Cooperstown as the point of origin for Doubleday creating baseball, which Doubleday never did, and Doubleday never claimed doing it, put the claim on Doubleday to make Cooperstown the birthplace of baseball so that Cooperstown could rise.
And folks in Major League Baseball at the time were kind of fine with putting out this mythology.
Exactly.
Because again, they were able to raise someone who was a minor figure somewhat, but a Civil War hero nonetheless.
Exactly.
You know, seemed like the right sort of person to invent the game of baseball. So that's how they came up with it.
Exactly. And let's think about what baseball was like at this point in time. Late 19th, early 20th century, baseball was a sport that was most popular in America's northeastern industrial cities. It was popular with recent immigrants to the United States and working class men, more generally speaking. So there's a bit of patriotism going along with the elevation of Doubleday as the inventor of the game. Civil War hero.
Okay, here's another example that's very similar in this vein. Why in the world do we still recognize Columbus Day when Christopher Columbus didn't discover anything?
So that's interesting. And I'll go back and share with you something that I found just last week on a research trip. There was opposition to acknowledging Columbus Day from nativist elements in the United States who did not like the idea of celebrating anything associated with Southern and Eastern Europeans, specifically the Italians in this case. So Columbus Day was controversial for less than savory reasons today.
Yeah, that's interesting.
For that reason, but why do we celebrate Columbus Day? Because Columbus did not celebrate or did not discover the New World. We like the myth. We like the poem. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. It all makes for a nice story.
There's another poem that probably has made someone famous in U.S. history who was one of a few who did something pretty good. Paul Revere. We know the name Paul Revere. We understand, we remember him riding through Boston yelling, "The British are coming, the British are coming." Is any of that true?
Yes and no. So he did ride through Boston. He did not yell, "The British are coming." That would have been stupid. Because
the British would have heard.
Well, we were the British.
Well, there's that too.
We were the British.
Right.
So if he had said anything, he would have said the regulars are coming.
Okay.
In reference to the British Army. But this was somewhat of a secret mission in the sense that British spies were about, regular army spies were about. So the message had to be communicated, but it had to be communicated in a sophisticated manner to avoid detection. And in fact, Paul Revere did not finish his portion of the ride because he
whispered in the wrong ear.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It started out, there were three gentlemen making this ride, and by the time the ride was over, the total number of riders was up to 40 as others joined in this effort to spread the news, but spread it without getting caught.
And again, it's because of a poem that we remember.
Exactly.
Him, right?
I won't say anything about poetry here. That would be easy, and I'm not going to take the easy shot.
All right. Well, come on. There's nothing wrong with a little rhyming.
No, there's not. There's not.
Here's one that most of us know about here in Texas and across the southern states, but maybe not so much in the rest of the country, that the Emancipation Proclamation did not free all slaves, nor did the end of the U.S. Civil War, technically, because many of the slaves and the slave owners, they didn't know.
Exactly, exactly. Or if they did know, this being slave owners, they elected not to share that information until another crop had been harvested, because they knew as soon as emancipation was announced, they would be without a coerced workforce.
And this is why we celebrate Juneteenth each year. Why is it, do you think, that that's a celebration that is very well known here in the South, but maybe not so much as well known in the North?
Well, because it is thus a Southern celebration. It is a celebration by African Americans living in the South of the moment when they learned of their freedom, and specifically in Texas, because the message was delivered in Texas. So if you think about the geography of the Confederacy, Texas is in the far west of the Confederacy. And if you think about the timing of the delivery of the Juneteenth Proclamation, Robert E. Lee has already surrendered at Appomattox Courthouse in April of 1865, and we're talking June 19th, 1865. So we're several months after the surrender. But what happens alongside the surrender, Lee's surrender, is the Southern planter class, who do not wish to abide Lee's surrender, start moving west to Louisiana and Texas especially, with their enslaved persons in tow, to try to fight a rearguard action against the advancing Union troops, to hold on to their way of life, their ownership of slaves.
I want to get to a couple of 20th century examples, but before we do, Mario asks, what is some of the historical mythology surrounding the Alamo that may not be entirely accurate?
Oh, gosh. So that is a very good question. Well, first off, let's think about which battle in the Texas search for its independence from Mexico is most important to the success of Texas gaining its independence. And it's not the Alamo, it's San Jacinto, which happened here in the greater Houston area. Go see the San Jacinto Monument if you have not done so at some point in time. That's the battle that won Texas its independence, but the Battle of the Alamo gets the mythological celebration.
And I'll also point out that Davy Crockett looked nothing like John Wayne. Okay, let's move on to the 20th century. Were there suicides the day of the big Wall Street crash in 1929?
There were. I ran a search just this morning in the New York Times, just one newspaper, and I narrowed the search to the week of the crash, and I found a handful of articles, 6, 8, 10, somewhere in that neighborhood, of deaths attributed to suicide, attributed to the market crash. The way the story gets told in myth is that thousands of people were jumping out of buildings as the market crashed. And the problem with that telling is it makes it seem as if everything was fine with the country economically before the market crashed, and then all of a sudden everybody was broke. And it was a much more gradual process than that. And the incident of suicide during the Depression, and this, by the way, is a problem that has not been studied much by historians, but needs to be, it continues as a rolling indicator of economic misery well beyond the market crash. There are examples of suicides into the early 1930s attributable to the Depression.
During the Depression, FDR instituted a series of policies that became known as the New Deal. First of all, was it new?
No, it wasn't new. And second, FDR didn't do it by himself. In fact, none of it would have happened had it not also been for a cooperative Congress. And many in Congress had been working on what we think of as the New Deal during the Herbert Hoover presidency, prior to FDR's election. What happens with FDR is you have a sympathetic president lined up with a sympathetic Congress, lined up with an American people who demand action, and it takes all of those forces coming together to make possible the various measures that we think of as the New Deal.
Were those measures responsible for pulling us out of the Great Depression?
No, that was World War II.
Why don't we leave it there? I'm sure there are many others that people would like to share. We welcome you to email us at talk@houstonmatters.org. I'd love to, if I could, forward them on to you,
sure,
Nancy, and take a look at them. And if
sure
you have any response,
sure,
email them back. Nancy Beck Young is a professor of history at the University of Houston. Nancy, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks, Craig. History have his eyes on me. History, history, history. History has his eyes on me. History, history, history.
The Rockets re-signed Chris Paul and Gerald Green, lost Trevor Ariza, while LeBron watch ended with James agreeing to a deal with the Lakers. Joining us now to break down a busy first 24 hours in NBA free agency and other developments in Houston sports is Jeff Balke. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Craig.
Let's start with the biggest NBA free agency news. LeBron James leaving Cleveland for Los Angeles. Were the Rockets really in the LeBron sweepstakes after all?
Well, they were up until LeBron decided to become a free agent. Once that happened, that effectively eliminated them from the sweepstakes. They, in order to get LeBron here, they would have had to make a trade, a sign and trade like they did with Chris Paul last year. They didn't have any kind of cap space to be able to sign LeBron outright. So once he made that decision, I guess last Friday, that effectively took them out of the running, and there really wasn't a good chance after that.
How does his decision to go to the Lakers impact the NBA Western Conference next season?
Well, I think that's actually the best question. Whether or not he is able to get the Lakers into a position of contending will depend a lot on what other players they're able to acquire. I mean, the Cleveland was clearly the third best team in the NBA, probably a distant third behind the Rockets last year. So there's no reason that him coming to LA is suddenly going to make them a title contender. But it does shift even more power from the Eastern Conference to the Western Conference. I mean, we're talking, there was a I saw a number yesterday where ranking, say, the top 14 players in the NBA, 13 of them are now in the Western Conference. I mean, that's an overwhelming number. And I think the NBA is going to have to look at addressing what they do with the playoffs now really more than ever, because with this seeding, you're going to get teams in the Eastern Conference that don't deserve to be in the playoffs and teams in the Western Conference that definitely deserve to be in. They're going to have to really think about what they're going to do about that.
While you can't miss what you never had with LeBron, the Rockets did lose Trevor Ariza, who signed a one-year $15 million deal with the Phoenix Suns. What do the Rockets lose with his departure?
Well, I think the thing is that what they lose is less important than how much they would have had to pay to keep him. $15 million over 1 year would have driven them deep into the luxury tax realm, even without signing Clint Capella or anybody else. You know, Trevor Ariza has been a very good player for the Rockets as a role player. He's a good team guy. He's very tough. But last year, as good as he was defensively, because he is a plus defender, he was kind of a negative on offense. And especially in a team that needs to get up and down and shoot threes, he was still a good corner three-point shooter, not very good from anywhere else. And frankly, driving to the basket was sometimes painful to watch with him. So I think just the number made it very, very difficult for them to consider re-signing him. And now he'll go to Phoenix. I'm not sure why Phoenix paid him that much money, to be honest with you. They're not going to be a contender. And maybe he's going to be the Crash Davis and sort of mentor the young guys.
Now on to the players the Rockets retained. Chris Paul re-signs for 4 years and $160 million. Mm-hmm. Is he worth $40 million a year?
So that's a good question. I think that Chris Paul, first of all, they're going to have to sign him to that if they're going to keep him. So I think that's part of the deal. They're in James Harden's prime. Chris Paul was the second reason that the Rockets ended up where they ended up. And but then on the other side of it, they were literally a hamstring shy of going to the NBA Finals, and it was Chris Paul's hamstring, a guy who does tend to get soft tissue injuries. His game does translate to someone who can play for four more years. He's 33 right now, he'll be 37 when the deal's over. But he's not a high-flying guy. He's not a fast up-and-down-the-court kind of guy. He's a guy whose game will probably continue to be a solid. It's just gonna, he's just going to have to try and avoid the injuries, and the Rockets are going to have to try and help him with that by giving him fewer minutes and, you know, hoping to sort of keep him healthy all the way through the playoffs.
Could we see a more substantial role for Gerald Green next season as he re-signs now for reportedly 1 year and $2.4 million?
Yeah, maybe. One of the things that's important to note about that deal is because he signed a veteran minimum deal, it only counts at $1.5 million against the Rockets' cap, which is a good thing for the Rockets. I think Gerald Green would play for $10 if he could play in Houston, because that's the kind of guy he is. But yes, I think we'll see an increased role from him. The Rockets are now going to have to go try and re-sign Luke Bamute. I think they can do that. And they're going to be looking for help. They need more shooters. And so they're going to be out there hunting down guys that can shoot and defend on the perimeter. They're going to be looking for another Trevor Ariza, another Luke Bamute. That's what they're going to want. And they're going to need at least another one of those guys to help fill that role.
Are there any names that you would like to whisper in Daryl Morey's ear?
Not at the moment, because I'll be honest with you, most of them are going to be under the radar. I think, you know, you look at a guy like Gerald Green, who was signed, you know, last year in the middle of the season, or somebody like Luke Bamute last year, seemed like a decent signing, but really I don't think people appreciated maybe what he could bring, or PJ Tucker for that matter, who became a really good three-point shooter actually last year as a guy that was playing in the four position. I think it's going to be one of those types of guys that the Rockets end up with that will help sort of nurture them along and get them further into where they want to be.
Is there any math that tells you there is a way for the Rockets at this moment to have a roster when they start the coming season that is good enough to beat Golden State next year in the playoffs?
They were good enough to beat Golden State this year in the playoffs, minus a Chris Paul injury. I don't think there's any doubt they have the ability to do it. It's really just going to be, you know, the fate of the injury gods. You know, as people said last year, sometimes the NBA gods can be cruel, and last year they just did not smile upon the Rockets. And I think it's just, can they be healthy through 82 games plus the playoffs?
Let's turn to baseball now. The Astros had a less than stellar week. After taking 2 of 3 from the Blue Jays, the Astros dropped 3 of 4 to the Rays. 3 of the 4 games in the series with the Rays were decided by one run. Any reason for concern, or just a momentary hiccup?
Well, part of it is that the Astros do not play well against the Rays. They've just not had they've not been particularly great against that team. And yeah, there's always going to be some concern. The Astros are going through another period where they're sort of struggling to win one-run games, something they did well last year and haven't done particularly well this year, especially when you compare them to the Seattle Mariners, who are winning, seems like, every one-run game that they play.
They've won 8 of their last 10, too.
It's ridiculous. And when you see that they're only a half game back of the Astros, and, you know, we have a long ways to go, and I don't think the Astros are going to lose their division or anything like that. But when you look at it and you say the Astros just are about finished with the softest part of their schedule, and the Mariners just went through the toughest part of their schedule, and they're still about even, that tells you that this Mariners team is no fluke, and the Astros are going to have to take them seriously going forward. I still think they have more talent overall, and the cream will rise to the top. But yeah, it makes it a little more difficult for them. I don't think there's going to be any free ride Septembers like there was last year.
It could be a free ride this week, though, as they play the Rangers and then the White Sox, a combined 34 games under 500.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's always good to beat up on the Rangers. It's always a fun thing. And then the White Sox are just abysmal. So yeah, I think they'll do well. Again, this is part of that long stretch of games. And look, they've been really good in these games. You know, setting aside the Tampa Bay series, they had been extremely good in this stretch of bad games. Just the Seattle has been really good too, and you know, that's just something you're just going to have to deal with.
Well, they've also been playing without Carlos Correa the last several games.
Well, Correa has a sore back. I don't think it's anything significant, and I don't think you can really count that against them offensively, because at the same time, Evan Gattis and Alex Bregman have just been on a tear. You know, Alex Bregman just today was named AL Player of the Week. That just happened just a few minutes before I walked in here. And Evan Gattis, look, a couple of months ago, or over a month ago, you could have argued that Evan Gattis was on his way to being just released outright from the team, and then he goes on a tear starting in early May. So
he and Bregman both driving in 30 runs in June.
It's ridiculous.
That's an Astros record.
And I saw Alex Bregman's OP, his something like .886 slugging percentage or something from the month. It's just crazy.
Jeff Balke writes for Houstonia and the Houston Press. He joins us most Mondays to discuss developments in Houston sports. Jeff, thanks.
Thanks, Greg.
And that'll do it for today's show. The Houston Matters team includes Michael Haggerty, Maggie Martin, Abner Fletcher, and Joshua Zinn. We had help today from Allison Lee and Brenda Ruiz. Tom Carter's our technical director. On tomorrow's show, our full menu foodies share their suggestions for the region's best hamburgers and hot dogs, and we preview this year's Houston Symphony Star Spangled Salute. I'm Craig Cohen. Join us tomorrow for those and other Houston Matters.
Houston Public Media.